This is Let's Keep It Real with Sandy Joy Weston, your weekly dose of positivity with awesome stories and guests from all over the world. It's an opportunity to learn some great new things and expand your mind. We'll tackle topics from all areas of life, and as always with Sandy, the sky's the limit.
Woohoo, my Let's Keep It Real people. Am I excited for you today? Just take a deep breath in. And I'm just going to start out by saying this. Number one, you're going to want to share this with everyone because everybody has a book inside them. Let's get that out of the way. And number two, I normally don't do this, but I have to do it because it's brand new. I am so appreciative of all your support for my TEDx talk. Thank you. Thank you. I had no idea how much you loved me, but the fact that you remember movement, words, and laughter, I'm cool. So thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. And Amy will appreciate that it only took me, 2 years to write the TEDx. All right, let's bring her on. Amy L. Bernstein is a former award-winning journalist who splits her time between writing fiction and nonfiction and working as a book coach to help other authors write with joy and purpose and find their own best paths to publishing. Her latest book, due out next January, holler, is called, I love this, Wrangling the Doubt Monster, Fighting Fears and Finding Inspiration. I don't know anybody that has doubts, do you? It's meant to inspire and encourage all creative people, which we are, who doubt their artistic abilities. Amy, I'm so happy you're on the show. I'm so thrilled.
Sandy, I am actually really thrilled to be here with you. Thank you so much for that great intro.
I was reading what you've been doing and what you did, and I'm like, this is like a month podcast. I have so many questions to unpack, but we'll get through it. My first one is one word. You get to pick one word that best describes your past 30 days, whatever pops into your head. And then why'd you pick that word, Amy?
Multitasking identities. We'll pretend that's one word. In German, that would be one word.
Wait. Say it in German. What would you say in German?
I don't know. Germans have very long compound words, so I'm going to pretend that was the English translation of one German word, because you said one word and I gave you two words. Multitasking, so we have a hyphenated word, but then I had to get the word identities in there because it's not just about what we do. It's about who we are when we're doing it.
Okay. Tell me more. Why'd you pick that?
I really love stepping into different roles that at the end of the day, they're really not that different. They kind of all add up to the same thing. So, when I've got my writing brain on, let's say I'm writing fiction, I'm really deep in that sort of that mode of being as quiet and creative as I can be. When I'm delivering writing workshops, which I do a lot of, I did a great one this past weekend, I'm really, all my energy is outward. And I love that. When I'm writing my Substack newsletter, I'm sort of in essay and confessional mode. It's a whole other thing. And when I'm book coaching with a client, I'm all about helping them figure out their journey. So I do have sort of these different roles and different identities, and yet somehow I have them because it all adds up to, I guess, who I am in the various facets. They all feed me differently.
I agree. I know some people say, listen, if you're laser focused, that's how you get things accomplished and that's how you really succeed in the world. But I've never been like that. And I would be so sad, Amy. I really would. I mean, it's not like on the side I'm doing like roofing, although there's nothing wrong. I mean, I am sort of doing the same thing. My whole mesh, mission is to spread joy, promote mental and physical well-being. It's just, I say my vehicle changes.
Yes. It's like as though we have all these different cars, right? And we drive whatever car we need for that to where our destination is that day. That's the car we get in, right? Like the snazzy sports car or the van or the, yes. I think some people are temperamentally suited to doing one thing, and they have their lane and they do it really well. And that's terrific. But then there are those of us who we need to kind of split ourselves up to feel for it to add up to fulfillment, and feeling like we're really engaged and fulfilling our own potential. We need to be doing several different things. But I think if they really end up, they usually do end up relating to one another somehow.
Yeah, they do. Well, Amy, My peeps were so excited that you were coming on, and I have so many questions, but there's no way we're going to get to all of them. But I'm going to bring out some fun ones, and some of them are some doozies, so I can't wait for this.
I love it. You could throw anything at me.
Oh, my God. This, all fake names to protect the innocent. All right. Sally Bell. Dear Amy, I've been advised to write a book. I suck at writing. I've watched other people write books just because it was good for business. But I know, Amy, they didn't write those books. Mm-hmm. And it pisses me off. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about people that are told just to write books because it'll be good for their business and they haven't even written them?
Right.
Love, so Sally Bell.
Love it. So, you know, ghostwriting is really, really big business. I am not in that business. I choose not to be in that business. And it's very transactional, right? So it's really transactional that someone will write your book for you. You just have to, interview you a whole bunch. They'll turn it into organized words on the page. You can add some things. You can polish it. And it's a very transactional experience with a goal, which is you want to get your expertise out on paper, be able to sell your book in the back of the conference room or at the trade fair, whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with that. That works for a lot of people, but you have to see it for what it is. That is the transactional business end of, hey, here's who I am. I put it between some covers. So now you can see that I'm an expert. And oh, by the way, you know, here's my book, right? And it is what it is. You can see it for what it is. And I think the authors can also see it for what it is. They're doing it for a purpose to further their profits or their profile, right? A lot of it is brand building. There's a lot of that. Now, let me just say in context, that's the one far end of the spectrum. The other complete other far end of the spectrum is that person who's sitting at home alone with a pad and paper or a computer and just trying to write something for themselves that gives them passion, joy, or helps them explain the world to themselves. They may never even show it to anybody else. This is the far other end of the spectrum. And then there's all of us, you know, all those dots along the line, right? Mm. And it's really whatever works. It's what you need. You know, it's what you need at that time in your life. So I'm not here to, I don't sit in judgment on any of this. I mean, I think as long as we're honest about why we're writing, what we're writing, and who we are writing it for, be honest about it. You know, don't pretend that you got onto the Wall Street bestseller list because by yourself, A, you had a ghostwriter, and B, those lists are manipulated. You can purchase lots of copies. If your company goes and buys 3,500 copies of your book for you, then you pop up on the bestseller list. Well, you didn't get there because readers loved it. You got there because you manipulated your way onto it. But you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I agree with you. You know, just be honest with what your purpose is. And I do know people that have wonderful businesses. And when they get out there and speak and they have a book, it really does help them. But I thought of ghostwriters differently for many years, which is you've done a lot of the writing or dictating, or they came over and interviewed you and they were just polishing it up. I didn't think of it that they were writing the whole thing.
Oh, no, the ghostwriters will often do the ghostwriting. Ghostwriters earn a great deal of money because they're really doing the heavy lifting. Like they may be working off notes. They may be working off an outline, which they have to then supplement with interviews with the author. They may have to do a lot of research on the author's behalf. And, you know, the author ultimately can sign off on it. But the ghostwriter is doing the heavy lifting. And, you know, that's more of an as told to, or the clue will often be like, you know, my 100 best sales techniques by Jim Jones with Patty Smith, you know, and Patty's the ghostwriter, not the rock star Patty Smith. I just made up Patty Smith, but Patty's the ghostwriter. And, you know, Jim is the quote, the author expert. And again, it's a transactional business agreement, and it's, you know, it's popular and it's very expensive to do.
All right, Sally Bell, I hope that answered your question. All right. I think I know the answer to this next one, but I'm going to get it in because so many people want to know. Dear Amy, have you always known you wanted to be a writer? And when did you start writing?
Right. Wonderful question. I have a yes and a no. The yes is when I look back, I can see that I always was going to be a writer because it was the thing that I did the best and is the thing that I came back to as a skill set, both for my livelihood and my pleasure and my torture, again and again and again. I remember writing a short story in second grade, and it meant a lot to me. And it was about a man in a grocery store, probably because I went with my mother to the grocery store, and that was like a big part of my experience. So, but the reason I said it's a yes and a no is, you know what? I was well into my middle years as an adult before I finally had the courage to call myself a writer. I thought that that was something else that other people got to call themselves, but I hadn't earned it. And it finally dawned on me, that's true. It is who I am. It really is. And so I do think it's something that can live within you, either expressed or unexpressed, for a lifetime. And you have to kind of figure out how to own that identity and really step into it if it's what you want to do.
You know, that reminds me too of people in the speaking business. There are people that say, I'm a speaker, I'm a keynote speaker. And then there are others that feel like, ooh, I can't really call myself that unless I make this much money or on this many stages. And that's bullpucky. It's just what you said. Irrelevant.
Right, exactly.
All right. This I think would have to take another podcast, but we can scratch on it. The process. They want to know. This is from, we'll call him Billy Bob. Do you have a system to help people if they want to write a speech on how many hours a day they should work on it and how long it will take?
Okay, Billy Bob, here's some straight talk on that question. With all due respect to you, you're asking the wrong question because you're looking at hard metrics for something that cannot be measured and quantified the way you want it to be. I'm a former executive speechwriter, so I actually do know what I'm talking about. I wrote in for big politicians in Washington, D.C. for a number of years.
Know what I'm talking about, Billy Bob.
Right. When you're writing a speech, well, you know, I mean, because I can just sit here and spew, right? But I actually know what I'm talking about. When you're writing a speech, you need to be 100% focused on what are the three big takeaways for the audience and who is the audience. So how do you leave them so they can really hear you, so that they want to lean in, and so that they get something that they can remember? This is what you need to be focusing on. However long it takes you to accomplish that is kind of irrelevant. Like, you might be able to write that speech in 15 minutes. That's terrific. You may have to revisit it day after day after day for a month. I mean, just depending on your realistic timeline. But so, it's funny because I just went through a whole big workshop and I have all this material, which is about uncoupling. Let me make an ancillary point. We, as creative people or as writers, we need to decouple from the standard cultural metrics about progress and productivity, because they don't match up with when we're writing and creating. Because writing and creating is about creating a message that's going to connect with whoever's consuming that message, whether they're reading or listening or watching. And you can't put hard and fast times to that necessarily. I mean, yes, we all have to work to deadlines, but that's a specific thing. And so, I don't like creative people to think about their creative output in terms of these hard workplace style metrics, because it's a real big mismatch most of the time.
I agree. And I know people that have written kick-ass speeches in a month and went up there and it's like they blew me away. And then I know others who took like a year and a half to 2 years to write 10 minutes.
Well, the problem, if people are taking a really, 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 really long time, let's say that they're floundering. Let's use that word. Yeah. They're floundering because they haven't figured out the core message, the three takeaways, and who they're talking to.
Yep.
This is what you need to know. You can't write until you know these things. When you know these things, then you can figure out your beginning, middle, and end with clear takeaways at the end. Set up the problem, set up the need, and set up the solutions and the takeaways. And that's really that's the bones of most speeches and even a lot of TED Talks.
You're right. Because for me, well, for my keynote, I wasn't clear because your thread line has to be very narrow for a 10-minute TEDx. I wasn't clear what I wanted to take from my keynote to put in my TEDx. Until I became clear, it wasn't going anywhere. And it was really difficult to decide, because you think, oh my God, I got one shot. You know what I mean? Right. And then when I realized that's ridiculous. This is what I feel I want to get out right now.
Right.
Then I really, in a year, it's going to be different if I was doing, right?
Yes, for sure.
So that was the other thing. And I'm going to sum it up because there was a lot of people that asked this different ways. There are a few people I know that have started books and then stopped books, start books and then stop books.
Yeah.
And some of them really aren't clear on why. A lot of them, like this one gentleman said, well, I just got too busy with the kids. And then he says, his wife says, you're just using that as an excuse. Mm-hmm. So this one man, he went to his therapist. I think that's a great idea. He went to his therapist, asked his therapist, and the therapist said, you're just a big chicken, bok bok. Meaning he was getting cold
to
meat.
It.
Yeah. Right, so right. I think there's a lot of reasons, but I would love to hear from you, Amy.
Well, let's just lay it out there. Writing is one of the hardest and loneliest things on the planet that you can do. Let's put it out there. It's very hard to do. It's hard to maintain the concentration. It's hard to believe in yourself enough that you have something to say and to share. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find the time to quiet your mind enough to focus on this task about trying to create a story or an essay or whatever it might be. It could be a poem. It doesn't really matter what it is. These are really, really hard things. A couple points. We live in a culture that doesn't support us doing any of that. We live in a culture where you're valued because you're busy, because you're doing a lot of different things, because you're helping other people, because you're out in the world, because you're making money, because you're taking care of your aging parents. And that has nothing to do with sitting alone quietly in a room trying to write. And many, many people who are trying to write also don't have the support from their families, friends, and loved ones. I mean, those people love them, but they don't get it. And they think you're just a little bit crazy or a little bit lazy because they don't understand that people who are artistic often think about the world differently. They often think differently. They process information differently, and they need to share it differently, you know, if you're trying to write. So there's a lot of strikes against us even beginning to do this in the first place. Now, let's make that even harder. And the harder part is that writing is a craft. I mean, just the way, you know, you're not born knowing how to fix broken water pipes, right? Like, you have to learn how to be a plumber. You're not born knowing how to, if you've got light switches that aren't working, you're not born knowing how to fix the electrical stuff behind the walls in your house, right? You have to learn. Mm-hmm. Writing is a craft. It's very, very difficult to learn this craft. It takes a lot of time and a tremendous amount of practice. So there you are alone trying to figure out how to do this. And so we've got all these hard things kind of working against you. And then let's pile on some more hard things because that's not even enough. Then you've got doubts. I don't know if I can do that. No one told me I could do this. I don't know if I can do this. I haven't done this before. How will I even know that I'm doing it right? Well, I'm not this kind of a person. I'm not really a writer. I mean, I know I'm fooling around. I'm not a writer. I can't. So you can work. You can be your wonderful own best enemy. It's so easy. So these are all the things we're up. And then we sit there and go, well, gee, why did I quit? I wonder. Because it is so hard for all these reasons. And so one of the things that we can do to address that is we need to find really supportive writing communities. You find a group of people in your town, in your community, at your library, through your state. There's a lot of states have writers associations. A lot of libraries will have information about this kind of thing. You need to find like-minded people with whom you can gather either in person or online and begin to talk to other writers about writing and begin to feel seen and supported on your journey. Now, that's different from a critique group where you're all sharing pages. And what happens is some of those groups become all about everybody telling everybody else what's wrong. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about supportive writing communities, right? And you can search around for those things and go to writers' conferences if you can afford a couple $100. And even if you don't utter a word the whole time, listen to the conversations, talk to the writers around you, go to the workshops and seminars, begin to put yourself in the milieu of writers, with writers, so that it can begin to rub off on you. Oh, this is a writing community. These are writers. Look, they're people just like me, and they're doubting and struggling just like me, and they have questions just like me. So it's incredibly hard to do this alone. And, you know, as a book coach, which is one of the things that I do, and I tend to coach nonfiction because I have a long history of working professionally in nonfiction, but it's the same whether it's nonfiction, memoir, or fiction. You know, as a book coach, I'm really there to support and encourage that author on their journey when they're flagging, when they need help sort of getting through the muck, when they get stuck, when they get stopped, when they doubt. I'm there as a book coach to really support them because this is so important, because I want people to fulfill that if that's what they're, you know, if they really, really want to stick with it, do it. So I'm sorry if that was such a long answer,
No.
but you know, it's a really hard, complicated journey. And it's no wonder most people, in fact, don't finish because it's really hard to do.
No, I'm glad you said that. Give yourself grace. I was like, keep
that's
writing.
Right.
Give yourself grace.
That's right. Exactly.
And, you know, I do know people in my group, in the speaker group, that they, I thought at first it was crazy, but it really worked. They set up a time just to be on Zoom, not to chat, but to support each other and write at that time. So they carve
exactly.
out the time, whatever it is, a week that they
yep.
want to write. And then they do it once a week with each other and just to hold each other accountable.
Exactly. I have so many friends in silent writing groups, and that's just what they do. And frankly,
oh,
you know, some people do it in cafes, some people do it in libraries, some people just do it online where you're all on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you just know you're in that virtual space where other people are also writing and you can feel not so alone. And that can be really helpful for people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. I want to get to some of your points, but I always get slammed. Sandy, you didn't get that many questions in. So I'm going to get this one in. Dear Amy, how do you deal with the critics? I'm a writer, and yes, I get a lot of accolades, but I have to admit, when I get slammed, it really hurts.
Well, that question is coming straight to the rejection queen. I should put on my rejection queen tiara because it's very big and sparkly. I have put myself out there in the world a lot as a writer. And when you do that, you get rejected a lot as a writer. I'm talking hundreds. I'm talking in the hundreds. And some rejections sting more than others. And, you know, you have to teach yourself how to grow a thick skin so that this rejection today does not mean that you won't have an acceptance tomorrow, next week, next month. It is never a so-called death sentence, right? We have to remind ourselves every single time, this person didn't take it, but somebody else might, and or I will publish something else in the future. What this is really about, it's so hard. My gosh, it's hard. It's about remembering what an incredibly subjective business this is. And just because your work didn't resonate with one person doesn't mean it doesn't resonate with others. You know what's really comforting? When you go on Google and you say famous authors whose books were rejected, I kid you not, if you want to feel better, go on Google and put that in. And then you should go down this rabbit hole, because so many, I can't like reel off names for you, but it doesn't matter. So
yeah.
many famous writers, both in history and now, were rejected so much. I mean, even a famous book like Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. It's a classic story about, same with J.D. Salinger, Catcher in the Rye. Those are examples of books where the publishers are like, no, and I don't know. If there's so many things wrong with this book, I'm not touching this, no. And these go on to become, you know, classics of 20th century literature. And so we have to remember that these are human beings passing judgment on material created by other human beings. And what this really amounts to is, it's not personal. It's not about you, your worth as a human being. It's not even about your worth as a writer. It's about that moment, that cultural moment, and that person sitting in that chair making a decision. A lot of the times, it's just that they're balancing a mix of things and they've already have something similar to yours. So it's not you. If they have something similar and they can't take this other thing that's similar, you know, and so it's about putting our rejection in this broader context, because it's the first place we go is, I suck. I can't do this. I'm bad at this. They hate me. And that's the first place we go. But we have to come out of that pretty quickly and remember there's all this cultural context around it that we don't control.
Yeah. You know, Amy, I haven't written nearly the books you have, but I've written nonfiction journal books. And my first one that came out, it took me a year and a half to get an agent. And it took a year and a half to get a publisher with first 37 rejections, and the agent was going to drop me. And then I went to New York and decided to take a writer course on my own of how to pitch publishers. Came back with it. She's like, we only got five big ones left. And the fifth one took it.
Isn't that something?
3 years later. And then once it got published by Skyhorse Publishing, which is now Simon & Schuster, and people were like, come on, Sandy, you know, even my husband, like, how can you take all that rejection? Doesn't it hurt? I'm like, I'll self-publish if I have to, you know, I don't care. I just want to get the word out there. Then when I did the book tour at the time, because it was about mental well-being and fitness, they thought I was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Nobody would book me on the East Coast. I had to go out West, and all my tours were in California,
interesting,
Washington, and Oregon. But my own peeps wouldn't take me. Now it's all mainstream. And I did think, that's all right. You know, it's just not happening now. Like, they just don't get me. They just,
it's just not happening now. And we have to remember that there's later. Yep.
It's not happening. Or, you know, we're not a good fit. Or, yeah, maybe they don't get me. But a part of mine was, it wasn't being quite pitched right. And they helped me, this writer's group in New York City. They accidentally put me in, I was a nonfiction. They put me in with fiction writers, that's okay. They still help me craft.
Right.
How are you going to get that message out? How are you going to tell the publishers and the agents what your book is really about? It was magical. Magical. All right, listen, I need to ask you this because it's so intriguing and you just threw it out there. You were a speechwriter for politicians in DC?
Yes.
Okay, when was that and what was it like?
I overlapped the second Bush administration and the Obama administration, and it was very interesting to be somewhat on the inside. Now, let me be clear. I did not work in the, I was not in any inner White House circle. I mean, the government's a big place, right? People think, oh my God, you know, were you like the president's speechwriter? Well, no, it wasn't the president's speechwriter. But I did have a couple really exciting moments where when the Obama administration was brand new, you know, every administration needs time to bulk up its staff. They don't have everybody in place when they first come in, and so I did get to write remarks for the president and for then Vice President Biden that I know that they used because they literally didn't have a speech making staff in place. And I was writing a lot about transportation. So I was the transportation speechwriter. So I got to write things about railroads and infrastructure. And it was after the 2008 market crash meltdown. And they had a giant infrastructure bill to try and put money back into the economy. And I confer, I know that like they had my speeches on their note cards and that they read them. And that was cool. That wasn't my only speech writing, but that was like a little high point. I wrote for a lot of other people, but that was cool.
Are you?
No, I do not. I do not. I left the federal government in 2014 or 15. So no.
I know. I mean, it just, to me, is so exciting. Like I love like knowing the behind scenes of when I watch people and I think, ooh, I wonder who was behind that speech. Cause you know, it's a team,
right?
You know?
Right. Right. Oh yes. Oh yes. There was a lot of, when I was writing for the Secretary of Transportation, you know, who's in the cabinet and oh yes, you're whatever you're writing, there's a lot of tremendous amount of political review. Yes.
Oh, Amy, the stories you could tell.
that's there is a little truth to that, and I will not be telling them.
All right, well, now we can get to the tips. If I have time, I'll get to some more questions. But becoming a more creative person begins with giving yourself permission to do just that. What do you mean by that? I want you to break that down.
I'm going to. And I think I really alluded to it earlier. One of the things that I'm finding in some of the workshops that I'm running and conversations that I have with people is anyone who wants to be an artist in any form, but again, because of the kind of culture we're in and the way that we're brought up, and I'm generalizing because there's a lot of truth in it, this starts with giving yourself permission to be that person because it's a different kind of identity and it involves different kinds of risks, taking creative risks. It involves trying and failing. It involves doing new things that you haven't done before. And you cannot, you can't do these things. And it could be painting. It could be textiles. It could be metalwork. It could be cooking. It could be starting a new company. It's any really significantly creative endeavor. I always come back to writing because that's the thing that I know the best. You have to give yourself permission to step into doing it and taking yourself seriously. Because if you don't do that, A, you won't be able to do it. And B, you'll never get anybody else to sort of see you as you see yourself. And that's important.
I know. I hear so many people say, I'm just not a creative person. And I think everybody is a creative person. Maybe it doesn't come out in writing, like you said, cooking. But I do agree. If you allow yourself, everybody has creativity in them. Who doesn't?
But see, we live in a world where, you know, that's suppressed. I mean, so much of our education, public and private, is not emphasizing creativity. It's doing, following rules, you know, completing tasks, filling out worksheets. And I'm not saying that some schools and some teachers don't do a great job at supporting their kids' creativities. They do. But I mean, by and large, we're not in a culture that is fostering this. So it's kind of no wonder that you grow up and you don't. And, you know, art music education it's gone from almost all K-12 schools. I mean, we're not even giving kids that opportunity anymore during the school day. So it's really hard to, we have to go find that identity in a way. You know, like, it's much easier to, like, oh, yes, I work in an office. Yeah, well, you and billions of other people. But when you say, yes, I'm a writer or I write poetry, suddenly you're alone.
You know, and I do agree with what the education, I think our teachers have a tough job because they have all these things they have to get done in a day, and they're measured by that, and they're conflicted. I hear it all the time. But I'm thinking about my son, who now goes to Tyler Art School in the Philadelphia area, and he was at a big high school who had a magnificent art department. Still in all, that wasn't the emphasis. The last 2 years of his education, we switched him to a smaller school that really emphasized the art department. And man, Amy, it was like a different kid. Not that they didn't do all the other things. They did. I mean, they had all the other classes. It was where the emphasis is.
Right.
Man, you would have loved it just to see how he blossomed.
Because he had the support to step into that identity. It was accepted. It was safe. It was normalized. And that's why I'm saying if you're writing
normalized,
alone,
you're right. Normalized.
If you're writing alone, you need to find that supportive writer community where you feel normalized doing what you're doing.
Which is the other statement you're making here: uncouple all your creative endeavors from traditional expectations about productivity and profit. That's damn difficult.
It is, which I just wrote about this on Substack, and I, which people are welcome to go find me on Substack. Amy L. Bernstein. I just wrote about this.
Hold up there, because I'm not familiar with Substack. I want to let them know.
I'm so sorry. That was stupid of me to be so assumptive. Substack is an online community where people can write about anything. It's like running a newsletter online that anybody can subscribe to, often for free. A lot of people offer paid subscriptions, and you can search by topics. You could search by people. And so it's a really wonderful place to find people writing from their heart, or, you know, writing about hard stuff. I mean, that's people who are writing about technology, people who are writing about music, people who are reviewing movies, people who are writing about politics, which, you know, I don't follow that on Substack, but you can find it. History, like there's a niche for everybody. And there's a whole bunch of us on Substack who are writing a lot about creativity and the arts and writing. And it's a wonderful community, both to just read into and to belong to.
So is it similar to Reddit or totally different?
Quite different, because you're creating content in a newsletter format on Substack. Reddit is more like, it's a lot more like Twitter, like where people are sort of sharing comments and ideas. This is about creating, you could think of it as like, I mean, I call them newsletters. You could call them blogs or long blogs.
Yeah.
Some people call them blogs. It's like that.
All right. So let's go from there. So they can find you on Substack about this subject matter. Now let's talk about it. Because this is big.
So I'm sorry. talk about what?
So let's talk about, you said you just wrote this on Substack about the traditional expectations and productivity and progress and how you can break away from that.
Right. That's right. So I've come up with something that I call the wave method of creativity. And just to boil it down, in fact, and I'd be happy to, I could share that post with you, Sandy, offline. You can share it with people and hopefully they can, ooh, they can just see it. It's the notion is that there's a lot of people out there right now who say, well, it's very important to write a certain number of pages every week. It's very important that your butt is in the chair for X number of hours. It's very important that you maybe write at the same time every day. It's very important that you set yourself a deadline to get your first 50 pages down or your first 50,000 words. And there's all these ways of pushing and measuring. Now, this works very well for a number of people, but it works not at all for a number of people. So creativity cannot necessarily be forced, and you're doing your work may be driven by opportunity. It may be driven by a moment of inspiration. It may be driven by something you read or see or hear or listen to. It may be a comment that you overheard can suddenly spark a short story idea, which you didn't know you were going to have 5 minutes before. And so where we get our creative ideas and where we find the time to begin to express them cannot always be managed in a hard way to the clock. And just because you're not one of those writers who's incredibly rigid or committed about it in a certain way, like there are people and they'll say, well, you know, I get up at 4 a.m. and I write till 6:30. It's like, that's great. They're amazing. We just can't all do that for all kinds of reasons. So the wave method has much more to do with tuning into when you are feeling creative, noticing the circumstances that make you feel that way, and trying to seize opportunities where those circumstances can come your way so that you feel in the mood to make your thing, to do your thing. It's much more of a leaning into a voice that's inside you than setting a timer the way my mother did when I had to practice the piano.
A lot of people have been there. I like that. I like that. Okay. Oh, and I love the fact that I have a whole new site to go to that I didn't know about. Yay, Substack. All right. So I like this because, again, it's about giving us grace. Your third point, pivoting to a more fulfilling creative life, need not happen all at once. Are you sure, Amy? You can get there in stages and manage risk along the way. So many people wrote in about this. That's a really big, as I call, sticky wicket from them.
Yes.
They're all or none. They don't get this.
That's right. And so I'm someone who pivoted from a very high-pressured Washington job, federal job, and I began to pull away in stages because I was just dying inside. And so I couldn't do this all at once, both financially and emotionally.
Yeah.
But over the course of 5 years, in fact, the pandemic sped it up a little bit. But over the course of 5 years, I stepped away from a series of jobs. I was sort of ratcheting down because I was trying to ramp up my creative life and my own writing life. And, you know, that's how I discovered book coaching, when I sort of was able to get my head back up above water and say, you know, how do I do these things? How do I become the creative person that I really know that I am and do that full time? Now, let me issue a strong caveat. I have a husband who is able to keep the roof over our heads. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has that opportunity, but even for me in that situation, this was a staged thing. This could not happen all at once because I was contributing to the bottom line. And I was then decreasing that contribution over a period of years so that we could adjust as we went along.
Yeah.
So, it's about being able to, you don't have to say to yourself, I'm never going to be able to, you know, I long to write. I long to really, you know, really learn how to bake these amazing cakes. You know, I really want to pull out canvas and paints. I just want to do these things. I just can't. I have to work. I'd have to this. And I understand that because I've lived it. But you can set your intentions to find small ways to step into this. Mm-hmm. And you can start trying it out in little bits. And you can start trying to think about and envision what changes can I make to my work life that are going to give me more room for these other things. And you may have to plan that.
Yeah.
I mean, I took a series of jobs where I stepped back from my paychecks actually got smaller. This was very deliberate. And my responsibilities got sort of more narrowly focused. So I went from a job that was consuming me 14, 16 hours a day to a job that was really, frankly, part-time. Like, this was over years. And I was able to step into these other roles gradually. So it's about setting intentions and really looking ahead and being patient with yourself. But don't say that you can't do it, because you can.
Yeah, and I like that. And I like that you said, listen, I was able to do it. I still had to do it in stages, but I had somebody else keeping the roof over my head.
Right.
It just wasn't all willy-nilly. And somebody said, well, if you really believed in yourself, you would just go for broke. I'm like, yeah, that's what you're going to go for. Broke.
Broke. Well, and you know, I think that's an interesting comment, because I mean, you can go for broke on the inside. That's what creative risk taking is. You can go for broke on the inside. You do have to create the circumstances in your external life. Because one of my workshops, I talk a lot about the internal blocks and the external blocks, right? But you have to manage the external blocks as well. So internally, you can give yourself tons of permission, right? You have to believe in that identity. You have to step into it. You have to claim it. But you have to manage the external factors as well.
Amen, Amy. So true. All right. We're kind of running out of time here. But I want to get a few things in. Number one, let's just talk about, you are a coach. So are you an individual coach, or do you do group coaching for authors?
I am an individual coach, which is to say, I can certainly arrange, because I do so much training, I can arrange a one-to-many situation. But I have a clientele of individual writers. In fact, I kind of have a hard stop at two, because I'm coaching a client at two.
Yeah.
So I have individual clients who I'm helping them develop their book ideas in the nonfiction space, which means, as you know, Sandy, it's up through and developing a book proposal, which is different from how it works on the fiction side. But I love working with writers who really are at the early idea stage, and I'm helping them step into developing their ideas to be as rich and sort of deep and interesting and, you know, layered as they can be, till we really know that there's a book there, and trying to create some structure around that.
All right. Where can they find, how do they get on a list for wrangling the doubt monster, fighting fear, finding inspiration? I can't wait.
Thank you, Sandy. Pre-sales aren't until September. Book publishing is like the last slow business in the world, right?
The
pre-sales will be in September, which means, what I mean is, that's when people can literally pre-order the book. However, I really am encouraging people to simply join my email list at amywrites.live. amywrites.live, L-I-V-E. It's really easy to navigate my website, join my mailing list, and believe me, everyone on my mailing list will know when they can pre-order this book. And if you check out Substack and you find my newsletter, Doubt Monster, there, you'll know that way too.
Cool. Anything else, Amy, before we go, that we didn't get into the Let's Keep It Real people?
Sandy, this was an absolutely wonderful conversation. I feel like we could talk for another hour and just keep going, right? So you can please have me back sometime, and I hope we get a chance to do that.
I'd love it. All right, my Let's Keep It Real people, come on. You know you're going to want to rate it, like it, and share it even just with one person that will be inspired. And until next time, you know what I'm going to say. Toodles.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to share and subscribe if you enjoyed the show. And remember, keep spreading the positive.